On the last 2 weeks, we talked about some of the implications of what we've talked about in anthropology. Last week, we talked about issues about race, ethnicity. This week, we're talking about gender, and in particular, I want to talk about transgenderism. We talked about the creation of Adam and Eve and God's design for male and female earlier and how that was corrupted through the fall. And so now we want to look at kind of this particular issue, being obviously a culturally a very kind of intense discussion right now. Now, it's easy probably for us conservative Christians to tell you what's wrong with transgenderism. But I think it's important for us to understand where this comes from. I think it is right to say about transgenderism, the modern philosophy or whatever of transgenderism, like a lot of things about the modern world, I think the correct way to view it is as a Christian heresy. And by that I mean it is actually a distortion of certain actually really important Christian truths. The reason I say that is because there's always a risk. The devil is very crafty. And what has happened typically on a number of fronts is that Christianity has advanced some new truth into the world. And initially the devil fought it, and the devil lost, but the devil doesn't just give up. So then what the devil does is he takes the very success of Christianity and tries to turn it against itself. So for example, take Marxism, all right? Now, the ancient world did not care about poor people. I mean, at all, you know, except to the degree that they could work and provide, you know, and you know, be slaves or be peasants who's, you know, the whole political philosophy of the ancient world was basically how to extract the most wealth out of the poor people as was possible without causing either starvation or rebellion. Christianity taught the world to care about poor people, right? And the ancient world fought that. One of the apologetics against Christianity was that it was a religion for slaves. It was a religion for the weak. A critique that Nietzsche resurrected in the 20th century, in the 19th century. But the devil lost on that, and by and large, the whole world began to care about poor people because of the influence of Christianity. Now, so Marxism comes along and it takes that idea and it twists it, right? And it distorts it. It's Marxism would never have been possible in the ancient world, all right? So it is a distortion of Christian truths. A concern for the poor without Christ, taking it outside of Christ, putting it into the power of the state, and so forth. And I'm not going to go into all of that in great detail. But you can look at a number of the kind of characteristic struggles and errors of the modern world. Feminism, evolution, Marxism, and I would posit transgenderism as well. And none of these things would have been possible in the ancient world without Christianity. They are teachings of Christianity which have then been distorted and taken out of context outside of the context of Christian thinking. But the risk is, the reason I emphasize this is because the risk is that again, as I said, the devil is very crafty. And if we're not careful, he will get us both ways. He introduces an error, which is a distortion of a fundamental Christian truth. There will be those that fall for the error. But there will also be those who so react against the error that they reject the truth that the error was based on. All right, we have to be careful for that. You know, when I hear Christians, for example, saying we don't need to worry about the environment in response to the excesses of the modern environmental movement, or when I hear Christians say we don't need to worry about the poor, you know, they're probably just poor because they're lazy and it's their fault, right? They're reacting against Marxism, and they're overreacting against Marxism or overreacting against environmentalism and so forth. So, like I said, the devil is crafty. He introduces these errors, and we really run the risk of either falling into the error or so overreacting against the error that we reject the associated truth. What is the associated truth of transgenderism? That might be a question that's on your mind. Well, to answer that, it would be helpful to understand the way the ancient world thought about sex, gender. In the ancient world, everybody's role in life was rigidly prescribed. And gender was one of the things that rigidly prescribed it. There were very, very rigid expectations about what a man was to be and what a woman was to be. And those expectations were enforced brutally often. Most of the religions, pretty much all of the religions of the world, taught that women were, as we talked about before, that women were intrinsically inferior to men, that they were less moral, that they were less human even. They were sort of like defective versions of men, was the way the ancient world typically thought about women. And so who you are, what you were allowed to do, what you were allowed to think, where you were allowed to go. In Greece, Rome was a little more, I don't know, progressive or whatever. In Greece, women were typically not allowed to leave the house. I mean, at all. You know, they were confined to the house. A married woman was typically confined to the house. In most societies in the world, a husband could, they didn't have laws for women. They had laws for men. The woman was under the law of her husband. The husband was the law. A husband could freely kill his wife for any reason at all. Because women were just not seen as fully human. All right? It's one of the really, really remarkable things about the Bible. It's hard for us to understand. I know today, you know, Christianity is described as misogynistic and regressive and all those things. And this is, again, part of this twist that the devil does. But the way the Bible talks about women would have been absolutely revolutionary to anybody reading it, offensive to an awful lot of them. Again, that was one of the criticisms that the Roman philosophers raised. It was a religion for slaves and for women. They thought it was offensive that you would teach that a woman was equal to a man. The woman had equal value in the eyes of God to a man was an offensive idea to them. And they fought against it hard. All right? You see a number of places in the Bible, in the Gospels, in all the Gospels, but I think especially probably the Gospel of Luke and in the book of Acts. You remember the story of Mary and Martha, for example, right? Mary is sitting at the feet of Jesus while he is teaching. Martha is in the kitchen. Martha is, when we look at that, what we hear is, oh, Martha's got a lot of housework to do and she really wishes Mary would help her out, right? There's a lot more going on in the story than that. Mary is sitting at the feet of Jesus. He is a rabbi. She is in the position of a disciple of a rabbi. Women were not allowed to be disciples of rabbis. That did not happen. In fact, when men ate dinner, women wouldn't even be present. Women would be back in the kitchen. They would prepare, they would bring things out, but they would stay back. It was seen as inappropriate for a woman to be where men were talking. Men are talking here, women are back in the kitchen. What Martha is actually trying to do is she is scandalized by Mary's transgressive behavior, that she is crossing gender boundaries prescribed by her culture, and she is trying to reel Mary back in to get her in line, to get her acting as a proper woman. And Jesus says, no. I mean, it's scandalous what's going on there. When you understand the context and background, the fact that Jesus would talk to a Samaritan woman, the disciples come and they're shocked that she's a Samaritan, that she's a woman. Rabbis of the day taught that a good rabbi a good rabbi should not even talk to his wife any more than it's necessary, because women just didn't have anything important to say. I'm not making this up. You know, when the feminists talk about, you know, like traditional marriage being a tool of oppression and so forth, it was, you know, outside of Christianity, it absolutely was. And so recognizing the tremendous shift and change that Christianity worked in the world, and the relations of the sexes are one of the really major areas where that's the case. You see, you know, when Paul goes to is it Philippi, where he goes, and there's no Jewish synagogue there, but there are a number of Jewish women that are having a Bible study, basically, down by the river. Well, what's gone on there? We know from history that all the Jewish men in the city of Philippi were exiled by the government there. They were sent out of the empire. They were sent to Arabia or some places, usually where they were sent, or Armenia or some backwater place, because Jews were often thought of as causing trouble and being troublemakers and so forth. And so all the Jewish men had been exiled. The Jewish women were still there. You couldn't have a synagogue unless you had at least 10 men age 30 or over. So they couldn't have a synagogue, but that doesn't stop Paul. Paul still starts a church there with Lydia and her household. You know? So what you see over and over and over again in the book of, in the New Testament, especially, even in the Old Testament, even was a model of progressive liberalism compared to every ancient culture around. Women could own property in Israel, for example. Women had the rights to the protection of the law. There were laws specifically for the protection of women in the Mosaic law. That was unheard of in the ancient world. Anyway, so what you see over and over and over again is that restrictive view of sex, the restrictive view especially of the roles of women, being crossed, violated in terms of that culture, to raise the status of women. You see it all through the New Testament. At the same time, and you see that because the gospel over and over again teaches the fundamental equality of all people before God. God is no respecter of persons. Barbarian, Scythian, bond nor free, male nor female, all are one in Christ. We're all equal in our union with Christ. The Bible is at the same time clear that this truth does not erase all the obligations of life. Husbands and wives still have different duties, different roles. The master and the servant, the king and the subject, and so forth. And one of the things you see the New Testament doing in a number of places is you see the apostles fighting against the over-interpretation of that truth by thinking, oh, well, since men and women are equal, that means I don't have to submit to my husband. And Paul and Peter and all of them are saying, no, it doesn't mean that. That's not what it means. There are still earthly obligations. There are still earthly duties. Men and women are still different. They were still created differently. And there are still appropriate obediences for both. And so just like the truth that the master and servant are both equal before God doesn't mean the servant doesn't have to obey his master anymore. So there's an over-interpretation of that truth that the Bible cautions against. And yet the fundamental truth is always and this is another really important, it goes to the issue of identity. What am I as a human being? You know, in the ancient world, your identity as a human being was fundamentally defined by your place in the hierarchy. Where you were in the social scale. All the ancient cultures worked on systems of patronage, patron-client relationships, where the patron was the social superior. He would do favors and give protection and so forth for the client. The client, on the other hand, would owe the patron his loyalty and his support and sometimes his money and his labor and so forth. Court cases in Rome were, if your patron was in court for some civil suit or something like that, all of your clients were expected to show up, and who would win the case was often whose clients clapped louder for their patron when their case came up. I mean, that's how the ancient world worked. You know, so you were expected to serve your social betters, and your social betters were expected to kind of take care of you and provide for you and so forth. And if you were successful, and then you'd move up the ladder and you'd become, you, everybody had patrons above them and clients below them. And the whole goal was to get more clients and move up the scale and become more and more important and so forth. What was your gender? What was your, were you free or slave? What was your nationality? Those things rigidly defined your roles and expectations in life, right? So for Christianity to come along and say, barbarian, Scythian, bond nor free, it was revolutionary. And to say your identity is not fundamentally about your demographic, but your identity is fundamentally formed in relationship between you and Christ. All are one in Christ. And that's what we've been talking about all through this class, is that identity is fundamentally formed in covenant with God, not in terms of one's demographic. All right, so that brings us to the modern debate. Because what the modern debate about gender and sexuality is all about is fundamentally about identity. But the modern world, and especially we see this starting with the romantic era, the Enlightenment. I would point especially to Voltaire and Rousseau, who started really pushing the idea of identity as being fundamentally individual. My identity is formed internally. Now that is true in Christianity, but in Christianity that identity is formed internally in relation between me and God, right? But to the romantics, the link with God is severed. There is no covenant, we are not made in the image of God. Therefore, my identity is fundamentally formed entirely internally. If you want to read a good book, it's a little bit dense, but very, very helpful on this subject, is Carl Truman's book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. Now, the degree to which we all are influenced by this should not be underestimated. Carl Truman gives an example. He says, if you ask my grandfather, do you like your job? He would have said, well, sure, it pays the bills. It's useful work, and I can provide for my family. And that's what mattered to him, right? He says, if you ask me if I like my job, I would say, yes, I really enjoy teaching undergraduates and I enjoy the whole intellectual pursuit and all of that. You see the difference. For his grandfather, it was all about fulfilling the social role. Fathers were to provide for their families. His job enabled him to fulfill his social role, therefore he took satisfaction in it. How much he liked the job was entirely irrelevant. It never would have even crossed his mind to talk about whether he found satisfaction in his work or not. That just wasn't relevant. But to him, as a modern, he's so much more influenced by that, you know, do you find satisfaction? Are you fulfilled as a human being in what you do? You know, to our grandfathers, great-grandfathers, great-great-grandfathers, such a question as, are you fulfilled in your work, would have been a nonsensical question. The only thing that would have been relevant is, does it pay the bills? Does it permit me to fulfill my social role? Right? So this, I always think of the, I can't remember whose poem it was, but we're so familiar with the phrase, I am the master of my fate, I am the captain of my soul. Right? The whole phrase is, it matters not how straight the gate, how charged with death the scroll, I am the master of my fate, I am the captain of my soul. It is a cry of rebellion. God will not tell me who I am. I decide who I am. That is the cry of the modern world. That's why any identity that anybody has, regardless of how absurd I might, and or how even actually impossible I might think that identity is not relevant. What is relevant is, how do you feel? So that it is perfectly acceptable for a person to believe themselves to be a man one day and a woman the next, and I must equally validate both of those feelings. And the third day, I might be a unicorn. Right? And we laugh, but this stuff is deadly serious. And it flows out of the philosophical underpinnings of the Romantic era. You know, poets like Emerson and Thoreau and Wordsworth, people like that. Walt Whitman were some of the American expressions of those ideas. Philosophically, it comes from Rousseau and Voltaire. But it is taking the Christian assumptions, taking the Christian perspective that my identity is not simply formed by my external circumstances and my demographic, but that severing that, but the crucial thing in Christianity is that my identity is formed internally in relation to God. And it cuts the God part off of that, right? They want the, and this is the whole, everything coming out of the Enlightenment. This is what the Enlightenment was. It was, let's have all the benefits of Christianity just without the Christianity. And you see that right down the line in all sorts of, you know, science. It was the Christian worldview that gave science to the world. Science never would have happened without the, it's no accident that the scientific revolution happened in Northern and Western Europe and it didn't happen anywhere else. That's not an accident. That happened for a reason. All of the founders of the Christian, of the scientific revolution, the vast majority of them were Orthodox, passionate Christians and cited their very Christianity as the motivation for pursuing science. God made the world to be understood by men and God made men to understand the world, so we need to get busy and understand it. That's what they said. Guys like Kepler and Tycho Brahe and Sir Francis Bacon and so forth, they all cited belief in God. Okay, the Enlightenment says we want all the benefits of science, we just don't want religion in there as well. We just want to, and that's why we are where we are today. Okay, so that helps us understand the philosophical underpinnings of the transgender movement, and I believe this is why transgenderism ultimately trumps everything. How come David Chappelle can't make fun of transgenders? Right? David Chappelle is a black man, right? You'd think that he's able to, because he's oppressed, right? He's a minority. He's privileged because he's, but transgenders are higher on the list than him, right? And the reason for that, I really believe, why transgenders are seen as the pinnacle of the oppressed minority today, the reason for that, I very much believe, is that transgenderism is the ultimate expression of this cult of the self. That my identity, I decide who I am, I decide what I am. Not even my biology can tell me who or what I am. That it is entirely a matter of my own will, whatever I decide to be at any given moment. Transgenderism is the ultimate expression of that philosophical view. Does that make sense? Now, I want to make one distinction here, and that is that I want to distinguish between the philosophy of transgenderism and people who actually are caught up in this. There are a range of reasons why any given person, and I think especially of all those 13, 14, 15-year-olds, you know, who are getting kind of caught up in this, and I think there's a range of things going on. I think there's legitimate mental illness. And what the best way to deal with that is, I'm not qualified to say, and I'm not going to get into all of that. I do believe there are people who really legitimately believe they're born in the wrong body. And there have been those people forever. And sometimes those people have been dealt with really uncompassionately, and that's a shame. You know? Because I think there are mental illness there, and I think that can be the result of trauma, or can be the result of other things. I'm not a psychologist, so I won't speak to that at any great length. I think there are also a lot of people that are just caught up in social contagion. You know, they know that, you know, if one kid, teenage girls are especially susceptible to this, although boys are too, but if one girl at a school kills herself for some reason, very often there will be a rash of suicides that follow. There might be 10 or 12 or 14 other suicides shortly after that. That's social contagion. It's you know, one thing that some have observed right now is that it's all the rage these days on TikTok to have dissociative personality disorder, to have multiple personalities, even though actual documented clinical cases of people having multiple personalities, if it is real at all, is extremely, extremely rare. And such people who have that disorder are miserable. It's really difficult. And yet all of a sudden it's become really fashionable for TikTok influencers to talk about their multiple personality disorders. And as time goes on and they get more fans, they tend to get more personalities, right? Now, is that just faking it for attention? I think that's maybe a little dismissive, but there is a kind of social contagion. People get caught up in it. And you know, if you're a kid who's 12, 13, 14, and people are telling you, well, if you're uncomfortable in your body, well, then you might very well just be transgender. Who's not uncomfortable in their body when they're 12, 13, 14 years old? You know, you're going through all those changes. Of course you're uncomfortable. Everybody's uncomfortable, right? And then you have all this pressure, and maybe you come from a bad family situation. Maybe there's not a good relationship with your parents or whatever else might be going on. And then you have all this, you know, social pressure from, you know, that you get this message all the time that just being like cisgender and heterosexual is super boring. I think the term they use now is basic. Oh, you're just a basic girl because you're heterosexual and cisgender. And everybody wants to be special, right? And the way to be special is to have some identity. Okay, so there's all that going on. And my intention is not really to talk about that a great deal, but more to talk about the philosophical underpinnings of the whole thing. Okay, where this comes from. Any questions or thoughts so far? The biological truth, of course, is that sex is absolutely a binary in the human species. There is male and female. There are not other genders. There is just male and female. There are intersex people. People who, because of a genetic disorder, their gender is perhaps less specific. And it is generally, that used to always be recognized as a disorder because it often would go along with other medical problems, infertility, and so forth. It does happen. Sometimes the intersex phenomenon, that biological phenomenon when people have their XY chromosomes, they have an unusual number of those, or various things happen like that. Because of that, that's seen as proof somehow for transgenderism, when the fact is those are two entirely distinct phenomena. Intersex is something like, it's debated, and it depends on exactly how you characterize everything, but less than 0.1% of people fall into any category of intersex. And even most of those are recognizably either male or female. There's just some aspect of that which is not as clearly defined as it normally is, and that usually goes along with other kinds of medical problems. Most intersex people are not transgender. Transgenderism is something entirely different. So that the biology of it, I won't go into the length there because I'm not a scientist, I'm not a biologist. I am a pastor, and I can tell you, though, that in the Bible, the gender binary is always assumed. God made them male and female. That's always the assumption. And while the great majority of the Bible is not addressed specifically to men or women, and the duties of the Christian life are not different for men and women for the most part, there are some exceptions. You know, husbands and wives are described as having different responsibilities. The male member of a married couple and the female member of a married couple. And, of course, part of that same discussion is that a biblical marriage, the definition of marriage, is always between one man and one woman. When we talked about the creation of Adam and Eve, we saw that, you know, that the beautiful design of the male and female and the way they go together physically, but also emotionally, spiritually, they're meant to complement each other. That is always assumed. The gender binary is assumed throughout the scriptures. And that doesn't mean the ancient world knew about transgenderism and, you know, the that phenomenon existed in the ancient world, and they handled it, they dealt with it very differently and thought of it very differently than we do. But it definitely existed. So it wasn't like the biblical authors weren't aware that such a thing was possible. They certainly knew about it. And yet, the biblical assumption is always male and female. Sanctification, growth in the Christian life, among other things, means learning to obey our biology. It means learning to obey our gender. Part of God's sovereign will in every one of your lives is that you were born either a male or a female. That does not determine 100% of your Christian identity or duty, as we talked about. But it doesn't determine 0% of it either. You know, learning to be a Christian as a man, learning to be a Christian as a woman, have some distinctions. We talked about it, and it is a patently obvious fact that the vast majority of men are physically stronger than the vast majority of women. Then you can measure this just in terms of something easy to measure, like grip strength, for example. The average man has a stronger grip strength than something like 95%+ of women. The average man does, right? I would guess that I probably, and I'm not a particularly strong man, but I have a stronger grip strength than probably every woman in here, right? Because that's the way God, I don't get any credit for that. That's just the way God made us, right? Now, so as if I possess greater physical strength, then part of sanctification is, how do I make use of that greater physical strength to do good instead of evil? Right? A woman, and you say, oh yeah, big deal, greater grip strength. Yes, compared to the ability to bear a child, greater grip strength is not that big a deal, frankly. A woman is physically designed, a good deal of woman's body is physically designed to bear children. That is a wonderful gift and vital to the existence of the human race. Not every woman's going to have children. Some women are infertile. That happens because it's a sinful world. But part of your sanctification as a woman is going to involve knowing how to think right about bearing children, how to think right about your physical design is different. And again, for a woman who's infertile and unable, again, that will be part of your particular sanctification journey, is understanding and dealing with that. Okay, so learning to obey God's will as expressed in the physical body that he put me in is part of what it means to grow in Christian sanctification. Transgenderism fundamentally is going to teach me that I determine my entire identity, including overriding my own biology. That even my biology, and from that perspective, I've heard it likened to Gnosticism. Gnosticism was that ancient philosophy that the body is evil and the spirit is good, and salvation comes from escaping the body into the spirit world. Transgenderism has a lot in common with that, because it says your body is basically irrelevant to your identity. But brothers and sisters, we are, and unfortunately, Christians have sometimes talked about this in a way that's unfortunate. I remember C.S. Lewis saying, I think I mentioned this earlier, C.S. Lewis, whom normally I have all the respect for in the world, but he said, you are not a body. You are a soul. You have a body. And with all due respect to Mr. Lewis, he is incorrect. We are body and soul. My body is every bit as much a part of my identity as my soul is. God put me in a particular body. Now in heaven, the wonderful part is, in the eternal kingdom, our bodies will be perfected and cleansed of all disease and disability and all those things, but we will still have bodies. I don't know what gender is going to look like or how that's all going to work in heaven. We're not really told, except we know there'll be no marriage. But at least in our present existence, we know that God made each one of us a male or a female, And so, again, a very few have disabilities surrounded that, have intersex conditions, and they'll have their own set of sanctification things to work out with relate, just like any, you know, it's like if a person is born without an arm, I don't say they're any less a human being, but I also don't pretend that a human being it's therefore normal for a human being to have one arm. A human being has two arms. A human being with only one arm is disabled. Still worthy of all respect, of course, but they're disabled, right? That's the right way to think about intersex as well, okay? So, as we learn to grow in the Christian life, one of the things that's going to mean will be to learn to think about our gender, our physical body, in a biblical way. Learning to be more masculine in a biblical sense. Now, or feminine in a biblical sense. Now, that does not mean I am required to conform to whatever my culture thinks a man or a woman is supposed to be, right? Biblical masculinity does not mean that you therefore must like football or working on cars or hunting or whatever other stereotypical male behavior there is. A lot of men like those things, right? That's great. That's why they become stereotypes, because a lot of men like those things, right? But that's not how the Bible, it's not bad to like those things, but it's also not how the Bible defines masculinity, right? Learning how the Bible talks about masculinity and femininity is going to be part of everybody's spiritual journey, about everybody's sanctification. Any questions so far? Or thoughts? We're all very quiet today. I want to make this point to close with. And this goes back to our whole discussion of biblical anthropology. The modern world is deeply allergic to the idea that you should have any commitments that you did not freely choose. I didn't ask to be born, right? The fifth commandment, right at the very outset, should put the rest to all of that. The fifth commandment tells you to honor your father and mother. You didn't choose who your father and mother were. You're still required to honor them. God chose your father and mother for you. You still have to honor them. And that is expressive of a broader truth. We, all of us, have a great many obligations in our lives that we did not choose, that God chose for us. You didn't choose what country you were born into. You didn't choose the color of your skin. You didn't choose whether you were born into a rich family or a poor family. You didn't choose the decade. My father would always like to say, you know, if you were born a woman in Somalia in 1000 AD, do you think your life would be any different than it is now? Yeah, you bet it would. In all sorts of ways, right? Trusting God, believing in the sovereignty of God, one of the things that means is accepting that God imposes lots of obligations on us that we did not choose. I could even say my wife. I chose to marry my wife. But gosh, that was 26 years ago. She's a very different person now than she was 26 years ago. And I am a different person than I was 26 years ago. Can I say, as the moderns so often do, well, I fell out of love with her. Well, she's not the woman I married. We grew apart. People say stuff like that all the time, right? And it's right for me to divorce. I should not be required and obligated to continue to fulfill my vows to this woman when I didn't choose to be married to this particular woman. I choose to be married to who this woman was 26 years ago, but she and I are both different people now. Don't people say that sort of thing all the time? Even my kids. I didn't choose what my kids are like. I didn't choose Henry would be who Henry is. I'm still required to love Henry. The modern world does not think that love that is a matter of duty is real love. The only love that matters is love which is freely chosen. See, for example, every Disney movie made in the last 30 years. The only love that matters is love which is freely chosen out of no sense of obligation at all. Which means that no parent's love for his child is actually real love. Because it's just an obligation, it's a duty. So it doesn't count. That is not the biblical worldview at all. It's very much a romantic enlightenment worldview, but it is not the biblical worldview. If my identity is fundamentally formed in relationship to the covenant that I have with God, I didn't dictate the terms of that covenant. God did. God said what the covenant is. My job, my response, my duty is simply to submit to the terms of that covenant or come under the sanctions of that covenant. God's God, I'm not. God decides what a human being is, right? Understanding that, and that extends right down to your biology, it extends down to your gender, your economic status, the country, the color of your skin, the country you're born in, all of these kinds of things about our lives, again, that we didn't decide, you know, physical disabilities or injuries or illnesses or chronic disease, you know, all sorts of things that people have that you didn't choose, right? And yet, it determines a great deal about your life. And submission and trust and humility means learning to be a Christian in the light of all those different kinds of things. Because none of those things are fundamentally my identity. Fundamentally, my identity is that I am a child of God. I am a child of God, a brother of Christ, a brother or sister of Christ. That's what fundamentally forms my identity. Then I say, how does that identity inform the way I live as a man, as a woman, as a rich man, as a poor man, as a master, a slave, a barbarian, or a Jew, or an American, a black man, Chinese, whatever it is that I am, whatever place God has placed me. And I think understanding that is understanding, you know, where the transgenderism, I think, in a lot of ways is the I hope this is the right word. The word I want to use is apotheosis. Am I even saying that word right? But the culmination of that whole enlightenment idea of, you know, of my identity is what I choose. You know, every single Disney movie I've seen for 40 years has this. It's you know, some you know, you could just go down to, you know, the Little Mermaid or Finding Nemo, or that's Pixar, whatever. But the idea is always it's a kid who they want to go be themselves, they want to be their own thing, and the father, so the dad says, no, that's bad, you shouldn't do that. The kid goes and does it. By the end of it, the father's finally apologizing for the child for being too restrictive. And, you know, how many times have we heard that story? But it's probably reductive, but anyway, I'm a curmudgeon, I can be reductive. But the biblical worldview, the biblical anthropology, and this is, I think, a great way to end this class, is that fundamentally, God made us in His image. That means God decides what we are. Freedom and joy and life is found in submitting to what God made me. And one of the fundamental aspects of identity for every one of us is going to be male or female. Any questions? Any final thoughts? Very quiet today. All right. Well, let's close in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for your goodness and mercy to us. We thank you for making us, for creating us in the first place, and creating us in your image, male and female. Thank you for your wonderful design, the beauty of your design of male and female. And Lord, even though we know that the design for the male and female has fallen into corruption and under the curse because of our sin, yet we know you are restoring that in Jesus Christ. Lord, help each of us to learn and to understand, to submit to your design for humanity, knowing that your design is so beautiful and so perfect. Lord, we pray that you would restore that beautiful image in each one of us
as we grow closer to Christ in faith and trust, and as we repent of sin. I pray all these things, Lord, in Jesus' precious name. Amen.